Well, welcome everybody to the fifth general session already. It's kind of funny on Thursday night when we first get started, it seems like it's going to be so far away and all of a sudden we're here. So I want to welcome everybody to the afternoon session. And we're going to start off by seeing if there are any announcements that people would like to make. So just a quick note on the schedule. We're going to be starting off with the blind history lady, Peggy Chong, and she's going to talk about a glimpse into our past. And then it sounds like we may go to the, depending on what happens, but we may go to the future of advocacy first. That would be our 3 p.m. Panel would be moved up. So we'll see. Anyway, let's just give it a minute. Any announcements? Well, it's just okay. About one.
Rob, ahead, yeah, Steve. Rob, this is Steve. Just want to mention again, because we didn't put it in the program, but after the banquet tonight, we're going to be having a virtual happy hour. Drinks are on you, but the company is on us, and Joe Green is going to facilitate that on the pre-convention Zoom link that we used right after the banquet. And just been confirmed, yes, the AI panel is moving up to 1:45, so that'll be the schedule change.
That will be okay. That's a definite. All right. Just a quick note, we do have an email address for those of you who are listening on ACB Media 8. We have a mailbox called ask@ccbnet.org. So if you have questions, Steve is monitoring that. And it's primarily intended for those who can't raise their hands here in Zoom, although it's also been used for passing information along as well. So there's a couple of good options there. And we've had a few questions so far in that mailbox. So anyway, if there's no objection to starting a little bit early, I think we'll go ahead and do that. So let me turn it over to the history lady, Peggy Chong. She'll get us going. Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate very much. I want to apologize, first of all, because I know I'm going to cough. It seems I've caught my summer cold. And wouldn't you know, it just happens to be right now in full bloom. So I'm sorry. I've had my honey, got my cough drops here, all that good stuff. So let me just start out by telling you a little bit about who I am and why I got started with blind history, and then go into a few things about California that I thought you might be interested in. I started with blind history because about, the late 1970s, so that tells you that I'm not a spring chicken, I was told to clean out files at the Minnesota Home for the Blind. And I was told just keep the essentials, get rid of all the rest, because we had a lot of paper. Boy, I regret throwing out all that paper today. But in the meantime, I was going through some of the old letters from the 1920s and ran across a letter from one of the Minnesota Organization of the Blind members to another, saying, I just met with our blind congressman over the Robbins bill. And I'm thinking, what blind congressman? I didn't know there was a blind congressman. And, you know, I'm in my 20s and stuff. I kind of think I know it all at the time. So it was kind of a shock to me because I'd grown up in the blind community all my life. I knew the blind rug weavers, the blind door-to-door salesmen. My mother went to the North Dakota School for the Blind. I knew her classmates. And I never heard anybody talk about any blind politicians. So I put that aside and started paying a little more attention to stuff. That's how I got started. I went to research that blind congressman and found out that he was Thomas David Shaw from Minnesota, who was congressman from 1914 to 19, 24 when he was then elected to the U.S. Senate and was killed in office. I've had the pleasure of interviewing his daughter-in-law and his grandson, and they tell me that they are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Thomas David Shaw was assassinated by the mafia arm of the Democratic Party. And if you look back, they've got some pretty good reasons to think that. And that is a whole story in and of itself, of which I'm not going to get into because he's not from Minnesota. But he was aspiring to greater things and very inspiring as a person. I don't think I would have liked him very much for a close friend, but he was working on issues for the blind early on. He had a service animal, a dog guide, by 1926 or 7. There was a school in Minnesota that had dogs, and he was one of the first recipients of the Dog Lux. And he got a lot of attention for that. He tried to get legislation to allow Lux to ride in the passenger cars rather than in the baggage car. And Thomas David Shaw was not a quiet person, and he usually got the dog to ride in the passenger car with him, but usually he was throwing his weight around while doing that. When I go to research people, I do it as a genealogist. And why I do that is because about 1999, I wanted a project to keep me busy during the winter. So I decided I was going to do my family tree. And I am here to tell you that is just as addicting as chocolate or Coke. I have enjoyed it very much. I went to a lot of classes. I was living in Iowa at the time. I've moved several times since then. I was living in Iowa at the time. They had a really good genealogical society. The internet was just starting to carry a lot of stuff like Ancestry, and Ancestry didn't have a lot on it at the time. So they had classes on how do you get your research done remotely. And the interesting thing I found about that was that they said, you need to know how to use people as your readers. A lot of the same things that some of us from my generation had known because the way to get things done was through a live human being reader. I thought that was very interesting. And I joined the Genealogical Society so that I could learn through immersion, if you will, how to do research, what was in the libraries, what were the tools that were there, and how to access them. I did that for several years and got to be one of the volunteers that when a new person came into the genealogical library, the state library that was headquartered in Des Moines, they'd say, oh, Peggy, come over here. This person wants to know about, can you get them started? And, you know, I could get them started on the computers, because there wasn't a lot on them, first of all, and I had memorized the patterns of how to connect into the different programs. But through helping them, I would find out new resources. And that's how I started to really learn about our blind ancestors. Because like I said, I had been collecting stuff from the early 1980s, I've been collecting news articles and books and magazine stories and biographies and so on. Once I learned how to be a genealogist, it was kind of fun to then, when I would get blocked on my family, to pick up one of the things that was in my pile and see what I could find on that person. Through that research, I've been able to not only find a lot of documentation about people or newspaper stories about people, but I've been able to interview descendants, and that has been very helpful in crafting some of my stories. It is amazing to me how much there is out there, and it is amazing to me what is not out there. There are blind people that I know existed, that I have some knowledge of, and they don't show up anywhere. Women are difficult to research. American Indians are difficult to research because their names change. So I find that for me, this is a big puzzle. And I gather all these puzzle pieces, and each story is putting together a little corner in my puzzle of blind people. Well, I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, so I'm just going to kind of get into some of the things about California. I know there's a lot of famous blind guys from California, and those are not always the people I touch on. I like to talk about the people who don't always get noticed. We've got a lot of folks from Newell Perry on up who lots of things have been written about. If there's a lot of things written about somebody, I'm not going down that garden path again. I try to find people that I think contributed greatly. I look for what I call successful people, and what I mean by successful is not that they made a lot of money in their lifetime or that they were president of a company, and there's certainly several of them that fit that bill, but what was the everyday person doing, and did they contribute to the community as well? Now, California became a state in 1850, and you think of all that territory between that and the already established states. That's kind of cool. 1860 was when the private school for the blind, it was for the indigent, deaf, dumb, and blind, opened up in 1860, and of course grew into several different programs. In 1907, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that the first woman's club for blind women was formed. It was associated with the women's clubs and was a chapter, but it was for blind women, kind of a segregated chapter, if you will. But it attracted a lot of the blind women in California who were already out there working. Many of them were musicians because that was kind of the profession that women went into. In the early days was music teacher, concert pianist, and so on. However, California's blind women did advance a lot in that you saw more and more of them becoming dictaphone operators, secretaries, and so on. So the first blind person I'm going to tell you about, he is kind of famous. I was introduced to him actually through a John Jakes novel, and I wanted to know if the character was real. And by golly, he was. And that's Christopher Augustine Buckley. He was born in 1847 and died in 1922. Now, Christopher Buckley has a bunch of stuff written about him, and some of it contradicts each other because Christopher Buckley was just that kind of guy. He was, he came out to California with his family when he was a teen. He started in the tavern or saloon business at an early age. Some say he went blind because he drank his own booze. Some say he had an eye condition that lost his vision within several months. Whatever the case is, by the time he was in his 20s, late 20s, he was totally blind. He did marry three times, and he became, through being a saloon owner, a fairly wealthy man. He bought and sold real estate. He became the person where, if you wanted a job in San Francisco at City Hall, You wanted to know Christopher Buckley. He was in charge of many of the voting places. If you voted for his party, you could vote in the light on the first floor. If you voted for the opposing party, you cast your ballot upstairs in an attic somewhere. He loaned out money, and if you didn't pay, you might get a broken arm or something. He didn't believe in knocking them off because then you wouldn't pay. But if you wanted a little money and a favor for your kid, well, you went to Buckley, and later on he'd ask you for a favor in return. He owned and invested in a lot of companies, especially in telegraph companies. He bought a lot of land, and when they would find oil on that land, he would sell it at an exorbitant price. So he wasn't the oil baron, but he was the landowner. Never considered himself a really religious man. He did go to church and everything. But when he finally retired from the politics in California, he bought himself a winery, the Ravenwood Winery. And upon his death, he left it to the Catholic Church. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Now, today, Ravenwood, you can go there, and it's a tourist attraction. They have a lot of things at Christmas and so on. I want to tell you about Dorothy Glass. Dorothy Glass was born in 1897, and she died in 1988. Now, she was totally blind by the age of 6. Her parents didn't know what to do with a blind child, but they wanted to be sure she could take care of herself. So they made her do all the same chores on the ranch that her siblings did. She had to clean the house, do the cooking. She had to clean out the barns, gather eggs, all that good stuff. She also climbed trees and rode horseback. At the age of 12, they sent her to the California School for the Blind, and she graduated there in about 1919. She graduated a little older than most of the kids because she started a lot later. Now, while she was at the School for the Blind, she wanted to be a beautician. That's what she said she wanted to do. Well, the school didn't know of any blind beauticians, and they said, well, you know, take these massage classes because blind people really do a lot of good work and make a lot of money at massage. So she did, but still wanted to go on to be a beautician. The school found a cosmetology school that would accept her. Of course, Dorothy had to pay for that because the school wasn't going to pay for that. And Dorothy was all gung-ho to do that. She graduated near the top of her class. When she finally left the School for the Blind, she went to the hospitals and so on to get a job as a massage therapist. Nobody would hire her. She really didn't have enough cosmetology under her belt. So after a while, she took some more cosmetology classes and then opened her own beauty salon near her parents. She got an apartment about 5 blocks from her beauty salon. She did most of the work except coloring and a few things like that. She hired another girl to do that. After a few years, she closed that shop, moved into a bigger place, and had more girls there to work as well because she's doing the books. She was always the one who did the hair, the nails, that kind of thing. The Depression comes around. A lot of beauty shops closed. Hers did not. And in 1934, we know she had at least 7 employees. And at one time before 1945, she had at least 11 employees in her shop. Now, she also took on a position in 1942 as PR fundraiser canvasser for the National Federation of the Blind. She did this for about 3 years. And the job was to go into the unions, talk to them and get them to support our legislation, the legislation that was up in Congress. So she would go and meet with these union officials. She had to raise money because her salary was a percentage of what she would raise as well. When she would get home, she would type up all of the letters to the officials, copy everybody who needed to be copied on them. And then in a few weeks, she'd travel back to San Francisco or wherever it was that she was meeting these people and, again, do follow-up. In 1947, she decided she was done with Cosmopolitan. She was done with her beauty shops, excuse me. And she decided that she was going to open a answering service. Her goal was to have 60 clients in 60 days. She wrote a letter to a friend and on the 60th day and said that she had met her goal. A lot of the contacts she had made with the unions were many of her first clients. She ran that business until 1974 when she decided to retire. And, you know, by this time, she's already about 77 years old. Well, not quite. Yeah, about 77 years old. So she retires, and she said her goal was to read all the books that she had missed when she was working full-time. Another interesting gentleman from California who has some to do with the laws regarding tenant workers is a man by the name of Charles Snow. Charles was born in 1877. He died in 1967. As a young man, he and his family traveled around the Western Seaboard, up into Canada. They were miners, most of them, drove in a covered wagon. He and his brother went mining in Canada. They went mining in South America. He and his brother became big shots in the mining company. However, he came back to California, and about 1917, he was blinded in a blast that he had only been working at the company for 11 days. And had he been working there for 15 days, they would have provided him with some medical insurance. Well, the family was broke by 1918. They didn't have any money. They had a daughter who was about 18. He decided he needed to do something. His brother told him, well, you've always been a good storyteller and a really great liar, so why don't you write a book? Well, he started to do that because the only skill he had as a blind guy at that time was typing. So he would sit outside and he would type all day. And then later on, maybe his wife or his daughter would review what he had typed. Now, you know, this is before we had spell check, whiteout, all that good stuff. When he learned to type in the mining companies, you had to type correct the first time because paper was valuable. So he was a very accurate typer. But typing these stories, these short stories, and they were usually Westerns, he would submit them to magazines, got a few published, but not a lot. So he decided he was going to run for judge in the county, and he did. The job paid $100 a month, and they were supposed to hire a reader for him, but that didn't happen. So his readers actually came out of his paycheck. He also had become a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle and the Sacramento Bee. They were usually little stories about things that were going on near Sacramento because that's where he was living at the time. He would send them out to the Sacramento Bee, and Sometimes they were accepted, sometimes he wasn't. He wasn't on the staff. So therefore, if the article printed, he got some money. But after a few years, he actually started to get articles that were paying. He started to write several Western books. Many of them, actually, in his lifetime, what did he write? He wrote over 460 novels. However, only about 75 of them were actually, 35 of them were actually printed in the United States. They were big in Europe. The army picked up many of his books and printed them for the servicemen. He was honorary president of the Western Writers Association. His wife died in the 1930s. He bought a nice large house a couple of blocks from his daughter, who became his reader secretary. He also hired other secretaries as well, because he was turning out books sometimes within a couple of weeks and getting them ready for the publisher. When he died, he was in the middle of one of his books. We're going to skip ahead to Glenn Hurlburt. I found Glenn fun to research. Glenn was born in 1909 and died in 1961. He came from a family that was not stable. His mother had mental illness, sometimes was in a hospital. His father worked on several different jobs. One of them was being sheriff, and he was gone a lot. Him and his brother, Glenn and his brother, went into foster homes from time to time. When he was a kid, he was blinded in an arrow accident. The arrow went into one of his eyes, and then later on, the second eye followed, which, you know, usually happens. He didn't get any blindness training at all. He didn't go to a school for the blind. He was in Oregon at the time. He graduated from an Oregon high school. By this time, he was already earning part of his living playing in orchestras and writing music. In the 1930s, he went to California, and he played as a radio station musician, played piano or other instruments from time to time. He got a permanent gig on KSFO radio with his own show. Now, back then, you could work this radio station in the morning, that radio station at noon, and another radio station in the afternoon, and maybe a fourth one at night. And he did a lot of that. He was someone who also worked in an advertising company. In fact, he wrote these jingles that had subliminal messaging in them, and supposedly was the first person to do that subliminal messaging. And the company, the public relations company, would let him tell what the secret was. But he was very proud of it. Now, in the 1940s, the city of San Francisco, if you can imagine, decided that they were going to get rid of their streetcar system. Well, people were all in an uproar about that. That just was a terrible thing. Now, a little before this all really broke free, he and a friend established Golden Gate Record Company. And to launch their business, their first record was the Cable Car Concerto. Glenn wrote the music and the words, and it was that sold over like several hundred thousand copies within its first few months. And by the way, it is available on YouTube. If you look for Cable Car Concerto and then Glenn Hurlburt, it'll come up. Now, Glenn was also somebody who he worked with PRs with some of the stores. He did the Christmas record for the store, had the doll that went with the Christmas record, promoted that as well. Radio started to stop having live music. He still had his own show until he died in 1961. But that's when he started contracting with other PR firms for writing commercials, and that's where most of his money came from at that time. We're going to skip ahead a little bit further and talk about Clarinda Manger. Now, Clarinda was born in 1896, died in 1976. She graduated from the School for the Blind in 1913. She was active in several of the clubs and so on in school, loved to write stories. She took typing at school, but then also, after she graduated, learned how to use a dictaphone. By the 1920s, she was working as a dictaphone operator for a newspaper. She also worked as secretary or dictaphone operators for several newspapers, a college campus, law firm, and so on. She worked through the Depression, and then in about 1947 or so, she decided she had enough of being a secretary, and she became a vendor. And I realized I forgot to tell you why I said Charles Snow was so important to the transient workers. And that's because his case, his lawsuit that he brought against the mining companies, was all over the papers. And laws were submitted and finally passed that said that if you had been working there for a period of time, 2 weeks, that the company would need to provide at least some medical for any injuries caused on the job. Now, I'm going to turn this over to you folks, and do you have any questions that you would like to ask?
All right. You do have one hand raised on Zoom. I don't know. Do you guys want to do email first or Zoom?
I think we'll do the Zoom first.
Okay. All right. So the hand is going to be Robert Acosta. You can go ahead, Robert.
Oh, my goodness. Peggy, you're wonderful. I'm on her email list.
Yeah.
Enjoy her thoroughly. And this is why I'm at the convention. I'm going to tell my sins. I said, she's on the program. I want to hear it. Couple of points. I know there's people who want to ask questions. Chris Buckley, I had the privilege of teaching a little California history at Chatsworth High School. He also, Peggy, you probably know, is famous for shaking your hand and telling the other guy who he was. He'd walk around and he'd shake your hand and say, whatever, Joe Smith or whatever. Yes, he was he's the answer to Honey Fitz in Boston. He controlled politics, an amazing guy.
Yes, he did. And he also had really good hearing, and yes. He would pretend not to, you know, he wouldn't face people in his bar, and he picked up a lot of gossip that he used for and against others.
I'm sure. One more point. You might think of Ernie Crawley, assemblyman who helped the blind and the Federation. I hope maybe he's written about too much, but he was great. And another guy that I didn't know about, I do now, was Don Wilkinson. Don Wilkinson, from a judge from Eureka, who the opponent said he's blind, he can't be a judge. And he won. Yeah. Don won. And I got to know him as we went along. Thank you. I'll let others ask, but you're wonderful. And thank you for coming to this convention. My best to Curtis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah. And I think that Dorothy Glass is in our Hall of Fame, I believe. I was looking at our website the other day and happened to see that name. So any other hands raised?
Yes, you have two more.
Okay,
next is going to be Andy Bracco.
Yes, I had the privilege of meeting and getting to know Dorothy Glass. She, this was at the spring 1973 convention of our state organization, which had a different name at that time, but she was 76 years old at that time, which is my age currently. And I have to tell you, she had a lot more energy than I would on my best day. she still was doing her telephone answering service. She was talking about, retiring. But she was the legislative bulldog of that organization. Her and Kathy Skivers were the Regina and Jeff of that era. And Dorothy basically trained Kathy on, you know, how to advocate with legislators. She knew all the big power brokers in Sacramento and in other areas too, in San Francisco, whatnot. And the thing I always remember about Dorothy is that she was the door prize lady at conventions. You know, when it came time to give a door prize, they would say, okay, Dorothy, you know, do your thing. But, you know, it's really neat to hear presentations about people and realize that you met and you knew these people.
And Dorothy was, I mean, she was a very nice looking woman, blonde hair. She always was made up well. And when she would go into some of these union offices, you know, they're mostly men, she took no guff. And they respected her for it because she was very nice, very sweet, very professional, and very firm.
Okay, thank you, Andy, for that. And who's next?
Next is going to be Charlene.
Yes, it would be fun to find the names that will go with this story, but there was a point in San Diego County you could literally have blind justice. We had a blind judge, a blind district attorney, and several blind lawyers.
I might figure that out if I spend a little time on that, because I have... my California file has lots of people in it.
I will tell you, the judge was a Superior Court judge. And I can't remember his name now.
Yeah, I can't say I've focused my attention on the justices in Montana, because there was at one time four blind judges in one county.
But anyway, I thought that was interesting and would be fun to find out who all they were.
Yeah, I might just focus on that.
The DA may have been from the city of Chula Vista. He's either that or San Diego.
All right. Well, thank you, Charlene.
All right. You have two more hands. I don't know how much time. Or do you want?
You say we do have more hands?
Yes. Yes.
Well, go ahead. We got time.
All right, Dan, you are allowed. You can go ahead. He lowered his hand. So one moment. And the last hand is area code 925 ending in 788. Second.
Earl, I believe.
This is a little off topic, but one of my favorite passages from the 70s was Alice's Restaurant Massacre, which also entertained a blind judge who really devastated the officer who had taken the 27 8x10 colored glossy pictures.
I wrote about him in one of my emails that I sent out. Yeah, because I wondered myself, is that, you know, how real was that song? And that song is an actual true story. And the blind judge walked in with his dog guide and just upset everybody's apple cart. It was fun. Which reminds me, I was just going to say, I do have a monthly email. And if you want to sign up for it, please just shoot me an email at the blind history lady. That's all one word. theblindhistorylady@gmail.com, and you can get on my email list.
Yeah, that's great. Wow, good. We appreciate that contact. Were there any other hands raised? We're getting probably time for one more question. If there's no hands raised, there might be an email. I'll ask Steve if that's the case.
I'm not seeing any emails, so...
okay, yeah. All right. So were there any other hands raised, or was Earl the last?
Let me see. One second. Oh, Dan, just a moment.
Oh, hi. Peggy, I think is your name.
Yeah.
I had a great conversation with you about a month ago, Dan Kaiser. And We were talking about Newell Perry, who happens to be the first president of the California Council of the Blind, and I was really going on and on to you about Proposition 19 and 1923. Can you tell us a little bit about how significant that proposition was and how it could have affected the beginning of Social Security as we know it?
Refresh my memory on Proposition 19.
Okay, it gave a pension to gave an income to blind, needy blind in California.
Yeah, and that caused a stir across the country. Actually, it did.
Passed by 2/3 too.
In fact, there's references to that in the minutes of the Colorado's organization, which was called the United Workers for the Blind. Through some correspondence, it's interesting for me to note how blind people were in touch with each other all across the country, because California had connections with Colorado. And I think part of that was because some of the kids from the Colorado School for the Blind went out west. Yeah. But the pension bills, they were varied across the country, but providing a monthly income for people that was statewide was something that was not, it wasn't approved of by some parts of the blind community. Other parts wanted it very much. Blind people, of course, did. But it was thought that if they did that, blind people would get lazy and not go to work. And it was the fact that these pension bills were coming up, you know, I mean, Social Security came around in the 1930s, but these pension bills were the seeds for providing a Social Security option and a disability option for blind people across
the country. Peggy, I want to really thank you for being able to give us these wonderful stories. And it's a reminder that blind people, there's so many things we can do and a lot of things you wouldn't expect us to be able to do, and we do it. So thanks for, again, for coming, and take care of that darn cold.
No kidding.
Could you repeat the email list one more time?
I would be glad to. It is theblindhistorylady@gmail.com.
Thank you.
So all one word, theblindhistorylady.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peggy.